Hello, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adey. Losing your career is probably one of the most traumatic events you could face in life. Not only is it your source of income, it's often your identity, and it's gone. For many, it's not that easy to move on and get over it, especially when your job is more than just the work you do. It's your calling. So for someone like a professional athlete, a dancer, a musician, anyone with a real passion for what they do, when you're told it's over, that's crushing. How do you make sense of what's happened? Sally Maitlis is Professor of Organisational Behaviour and Leadership in the Said Business School at the University of Oxford. She's studied sense-making and the impact that a career-ending event can have.
So I understand sense-making to be the process through which people work to try and understand issues or events that are novel or ambiguous, or they're confusing, or that in some other way they violate our expectations. So if you asked me that question and I began to talk about how unseasonably warm it is in England right now, it would trigger you into a sense-making process of wondering what's happened, what's going on, and what should I do about it?
So it's a bit beyond that kind of innately human thing, which is to tell stories that explain things afterwards.
Well, actually, that's at the very core of it. I mean, the very core of it is that you're trying to work out what's happening. And the way that you do that is you think about it, you talk to other people about it, you read about it, and you try and put together a story for yourself or for yourselves of what you think has happened.
This is both an internal process and also something that's innately social.
Yes, and that side of it has often been ignored because people think that we make sense in our heads. But when you really look around and think, well, what do people do when they can't figure something out? They turn to others, they call meetings, they gossip by the water cooler. You know, it's a highly social process, and of course, it's also going on in your head. But that's not the only place it happens. It's maybe not even the central place it happens.
And if it's going on in meetings and happening in conversations in corridors and you know, canteens and at the water cooler, then it's both an official and an unofficial process.
Yes. So often what we call the official process is leaders doing sense giving, which is trying to impart their understanding of what's happening to others and to get them to buy into it. But at the same time, all the other people in an organization are choosing to decide, does that story sound credible? Do we go with it? What do we think's going on? And so it's this real sort of intersection of people giving sense, people making sense of what they're hearing, people trying to find out their own meaning.
So it's really easy to imagine, and indeed I have worked in places where this has happened, where there's more than one narrative around. There's the official one, and there's the one that everybody else thinks, or that you think.
Yeah, and even more than two, you know, like many, many narratives. And particularly, I mean, some of my research has looked at how tightly controlled sense-making processes are by leaders in organizations. And if they sort of lose the plot, or they step back, or they're not leading the sense-making process, there can be a real proliferation of different narratives that compete with each other to become the dominant one in the organization and often win out over the leader's narrative.
What happens when that happens?
Well, you get all these, you get a lot of story, a lot of disruption, and you end up having actions which are often inconsistent with each other. So the kinds of responses that come, I mean, you can see it in England right now with this Grenfell Tower, you know, this disaster with the tower in London that went up in flames. Everybody is in there trying to make sense of what happened, whose fault was it, what should we do, what does it say about social inequality in Britain. And it's you know, chaos, as you see. And then gradually, what you will find, as with something like the VW emissions scandal, a sort of dominant story ultimately emerges. But there can be a lot of tussle before that happens.
What I'm struck by, and when you talk about Grenfell Tower, I really thought this the other day. You're right. Immediately, lots of stories. This is what caused it. It's these people's fault. And at the moment, we're very unlikely to know exactly what happened. That process takes time. And yet we can't help ourselves, can we?
No. We're all drawn into it. In fact, the more ambiguous it is and the more emotional an event it is, the more we're drawn in and everybody's trying to figure it out.
Well, let's talk about a traumatic event of a smaller scale, because you've looked at what happens when people go through kind of traumatic events at work in the cultural industry. So when a career is unexpectedly cut short, perhaps by an injury or something like that. How does sense-making make sense of that?
Well, so what I've studied are musicians and dancers who have experienced an injury and that has stopped them from being able to do the work that is just central to everything they've known and central to their identities. And when that happens, when they have an injury, first of all, there's a lot of sense-making around what does this injury mean? Is it really there? Is it there to stay? What does it mean for my future? And a real desire in that process to, on one hand, make sense of it, and at the same time, to really find that it doesn't mean anything significant because these people are so invested in what they do. They've done it since they were 3 or 4, and this is just everything that they've known. But gradually, certainly for the group that I have studied, eventually it becomes very increasingly clear that this is really going to be the end of what they've known. And then this intensifies their sense-making because now they're not just trying to work out what does the injury mean, they're trying to work out what does this mean for me and who I am and who I can be going forward. And that's the process that I've been studying over about 8 or 9 years, following these people through coming to terms with the fact they have an injury and then beginning to try to make sense of who can I be if I'm not the cellist, if I'm not the drummer of a successful band, if I'm not, a ballerina.
So is there a right way to do that?
Well, there isn't a right way to do that, but there is a way to do that that ends up leaving people either continuing to struggle with being, you know, as one of my participants put it, a not dancer. They see themselves as a diminished form of what they were. Or in the most uplifting cases, people make sense in ways that allows them to feel they've really become bigger. They've grown from this experience, which is a trauma for them. For them, it is as big a trauma as the Tower in London. It's everything they've ever cared about has been taken. And they find over many, many years, this isn't an instant wake up and, you know, see that the sky is bluer, but over many years say, you know, I really loved what I did. It was so important. I still miss it. And through this process, I've discovered all these other aspects of myself and of life that simply would never have been shown to me if I had carried on in dance or in the orchestra.
When you explain it like that, it makes me realize that what you're talking about is a re-engineering of identity. It's massive.
Yeah, it is.
And, of course, careers don't just end because of catastrophic injury. People, industries change, people lose their jobs. I work in the media. We're being shaken up in an almighty manner. Many journalists have lost their jobs. Can you kind of apply this way of dealing with things to other circumstances?
Yes, absolutely. So that, I mean, I know someone at Yale, Winnie Jiang, who's studying exactly what you've just described, what happens when journalists find that their very profession is undergoing such change that they can't, however good they are, they really can't carry on in the same way that they wanted to. And that causes a whole, you know, enormous group of people to try to work out who they can be in that changing environment. And then people, anybody who's laid off, even people who have to retire, it's everything that I was is no longer. And what can I be now?
So for the manager who has to deliver the bad news, is there any way of doing this that gets the sense-making going? Because it's awful news, isn't it?
Yeah, it is awful news. And sadly, as with much awful news in organisations, people often don't deal with it very well because they find it so difficult themselves to face. And so the best thing that a manager can do is to really acknowledge for that person or that group and to normalise the feelings of loss that they must be having and not to say, oh, you know, it's okay and I'm sure you'll be fine and we've got you some outplacement and, you know, look on the bright side. I mean, that's a hopeless, a destructive thing to do, but to really say, yes, this must be very, very difficult for you. Many people feel this way, and not to rush them or push them into trying to make sense of it, but to create opportunities for them to reflect on what's happened, to think about who have they been? Who might they become? And other people can be very helpful in this process. Something I found in my study is because of the pain of it and the shame of it for many people, they take themselves away, they withdraw from their colleagues, they withdraw even from their partners and just, you know, sit with it themselves. But to be able to talk not only to sort of coaches and counselors, but to other people who've been through some kind of process and come through it can be enormously helpful for them. So it's about giving people the space to do this, not about giving them advice, and helping them begin to, or supporting them in experimenting with what could be. So a lot of sense making happens through action. You know, you try something and then that shows you that that's a new way to be, then you do more of it.
Is it worse when it's because another area in you that you work in and have written about is a calling. And I'm sure that's what it is for a musician or dancer. Yeah. They cannot be doing it for the money. And for many people in my craft journalism, they would view it that way too. If it's a calling, of course, you know, you put in more, but it's more of a wrench when it's finished.
Yeah, it's the worst. I don't want to say it's the worst, but it's a very, very strong example of this, because people truly believe this is what they are meant to be doing, and everything else can seem very empty. And so in some of the research that I've done with Kira Shabram at University of Washington in Seattle, we looked at people who have a calling, who encounter adversity, and what we found was that people don't just have a calling. People have a different kinds of callings. And so for some people, the calling is really about making a contribution in the world. And it may be captured in journalism, for example. But if journalism is taken away, and these are people who really want to make a difference in the world, they can be helped to find other professions that they can make a meaningful difference in. And that can be a real recovery process. But there are other people for whom the calling is all about their identity, all about this is a unique gift that I feel I have and this is where I must express it. And they need to be helped to find other gifts and talents and skills they have that could be exercised in other kinds of work. And so it's a matter of helping them find different ways to express other pieces of themselves. And then there was a third group for whom the calling is really about learning and mastering some work they feel is important. And in some ways, that's the most versatile kind of calling, because you say, well, what I want to do is, it's not that I have unique gifts, it's not that I have to make a contribution to a cause, it's that I want to learn and master something meaningful. And for them, it will be much easier to find other areas that they can go and they can master, and they can build a sort of community of practice around that work.
Something that's, again, an area that you've done work in, and it's sort of about this, is that many businesses, corporations, even public sector employees, are often end up being thought of as kind of cold-hearted. You know, and it's because, you know, they're doing this thing, they have to make this decision, it's rational, they don't really like it, so they pretend that it's very rational. And you say, well, look, there's need for more compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is a body of research that I've been doing for many years with wonderful colleagues. And we have a collaborative community we call the Compassion Lab. And we've set out to study where compassion can be found in organizations and what happens when you find it. And what we find is that, you know, in organizations where compassion is shown to people who are suffering, and especially in organizations where it can be woven into the culture of the organization, you find employees are not only more committed, but the organization builds a capacity for resilience in the face of adversity, because people are sharing their time and their resources and their attention with those who need a little bit of care at a certain time. And this makes such a difference. And so more and more businesses are discovering, you know, that a compassionate workplace isn't this kind of soft place where you let everybody off the hook and you go around hugging all the time, but one where people can give their best to the organization because they feel connected to other people, and they are in the knowledge that the organization is there for them in times of difficulty. And so they're going to feel very grateful, very loyal, very committed. And as soon as they're back on track, they're going to really give more than they ever did to the organization. So it's not compassion or productivity. It's really productivity through compassion.
Yes, but it's got to be real, hasn't it? You can't say we now have a compassion policy. Look, here are the forms. You've got to mean it. You've got to act it. It's got to be the thing that you feel yourself.
Yes, it is. But also putting in some routines, you know, organizations who allow employees to donate unused vacation time to other employees who need it. That's something that, you know, is a system. It is an organizational routine. It can make a massive difference. And if you don't like it and you don't believe in it, you don't need to do it. But it's there for you if you want to express that. But yeah, there's nothing worse than the sort of pseudo compassionate leader who pretends that, you know, he or she cares about the employees. And then by all their actions, it's absolutely obvious that they don't.
Sally, thanks very much for sharing your ideas today.
Thank you. Thanks for the conversation.
Professor Sally Maitlis is in the Said Business School at the University of Oxford. On RN, the ABC Radio app, wherever you get your podcasts, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adie. Big, established firms often do a great job of rapidly adopting new technologies. With success, leaders are often more willing to innovate, even when such innovations are out of step with their usual way of doing things. Stanford University's Bill Barnett calls that paradoxical problem success bias. He says leaders can misread their success at one game and so readily launch into another, whether the organization's suited for that business or not.
The most successful people and companies are the people and companies who are most likely to make the next change. They're going to speak with great force. At a business meeting, someone who's made a good decision carries a lot of weight. And when it comes to innovating in an industry, a successful incumbent firm gets the backing of the capital markets and key constituencies for its big innovations. The problem is that those very firms will tend to make changes that are entirely consistent with the current way that we play the game. They will tend not to innovate in disruptive ways. And so, on the one hand, they're the most likely to make a change and put the new technologies in the place. On the other hand, they're the most likely to fail after they do that because they don't understand the logic of the new business. And my colleague Elizabeth Ponticus and I, Professor Ponticus is at the University of Chicago, Elizabeth and I found very conclusive evidence of this looking at data on a large number of firms over time.
Yeah, one of the examples I've read about that is in the tech sector. So, and you talk about the mini computers, and I just about remember the mini computers in the 70s, so Data General, DEC. But of course, they got obliterated by the PC revolution. IBM, Microsoft became very big. But you say the success bias stopped Data General and DEC from succeeding in this new, market.
Well, that's right. They were actually quick to move, but also quick to fail, given that they moved. Because it's one thing to put the technology into place. It's another thing to understand the new logic. And maybe I'll give a different example that would be more familiar to many listeners. Think of the gaming consoles that are popular in many parts of the world. The Xbox, the PlayStation, and so forth. Well, these gaming consoles, of course, they are gaming consoles, but they are also a gateway to the connected digital home. What's interesting is that the firms that made the initial innovations in gaming, Microsoft, Sony, understood them as gaming consoles rather than as the digital gateway to the home. And there has been a period of time now where everyone with an Xbox probably also has a Windows-based computer somewhere in their house. So they have Microsoft controlling, if you will, the study as well as the living room and the set-top box. But those different parts of Microsoft were not talking to each other. The logic that you would actually be the gateway to the digital home, controlling access to media, controlling all sorts of wireless transmission capability and communication capability. This was completely missed by the companies that instead were marketing gaming boxes. So, you know, the disruption isn't in the technology. The disruption is in the logic that we use when we employ the technology.
Bill, how do firms who are innovating, who are good at technology, how do they not fall into this trap?
Yeah. You know, the best leaders understand that it is not their job to know, that instead it is their job to create the systems that discover. Once you realize that you're not going to be able to predict what's next, instead, you focus on putting in place the right people structured in the right kind of architecture, working according to a set of routines and within an organizational culture that allows for the discovery of new possibilities that the leaders really might not have imagined themselves. You know, a great example of this is Steve Jobs. If you look, as I have done, at every single change brought on by Steve Jobs at Apple, from the time he re-entered Apple in the late 90s until the present era and his untimely and unfortunate death, if you look at all of those changes, without exception, every change that his team put in place was meant to do something that was perfectly rational and a great idea with respect to its old strategy, but that then triggered events they never would have imagined, in turn leading to a new strategy. So they implement iTunes to make the computer more valuable. They then release the iPod to make iTunes more valuable, to make the computer more valuable. It's trying to sell desktop computers was their game. Of course, then they end up selling more music than they're selling computers, to the point where they drop the name computer from the company and really become a music company. At that point, they release iTunes on the PC. They're no longer, at that point, even trying to win against the PC. And of course, with the iPhone, that evolution continues. In the midst of that, Steve Jobs spoke here at Stanford and famously said, you cannot connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect the dots looking backward. Now, what makes you a leader is not just that ability to connect the dots, but once you've connected to the dots, to turn that understanding of your firm's success into a strategy that guides future action.
Part of the problem of success bias is you're good at something and you then think that you'll be good at something else and you stuff it up. But if we can only make sense afterwards, then it does seem to me very hard to succeed at this.
Well, you know, pattern recognition is key here, Richard. If we recognize a change and we see the new logic in that change, then we can transform the logic of our business and really move into a completely new direction, a direction that we never would have imagined earlier. And this does happen. It's happened in a variety of industries. It's often incredibly painful. It often requires that firms go through upheaval while their old capabilities are left behind. I remember when I was young, I worked for the phone company. You know, we used to call it the phone company because we really just had one. And it was a miracle of organization. Many people called it a so-called natural monopoly because everybody thought if you had one system, you had to have one company. And while I was there, they broke up the company. I lost my job, had to go back to school. And everyone, all of the pundits were wringing their hands over the fact that now there'll be no innovation in telecommunications. Well, of course, you couldn't have been more wrong. It was precisely introducing competition into telecommunications that led to the era that we are now in, where wireless communication has taken over our lives. And of course, innovation has never been more powerful. Now, some of the companies that were involved back then, including AT&T, still exist today. They just don't look anything like what they looked like back then because the changes necessary to compete according to the new logic are so overwhelming. And I think that's the hard part. As a leader, we can recognize the new pattern. We can even see the new logic. The difficulty is taking an organization that was optimized for an old logic and getting it to change to compete in a new logic. It's much easier to grow a new organization in that new context than it is to transform an existing organization. Both are possible, but both are big leadership challenges.
Bill, it's been really interesting. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
William Barnett is Professor of Business Leadership, Strategy and Organizations at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. And that's the show. Best Practice is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. and I'm Richard Ady.